It must be Dr. Vanderwerf, Dean of Science and Engineering at Seattle University in Washington. He holds degrees from MIT and Oxford. He's taught and done research in Africa and a number of American universities, both as an engineer and a biomedical engineer. He's been a fellow at Los Alamos Scientific Laboratories and is engaged in this major inquiry that will take him the rest of the year on science advice to save life. I think it's a great opportunity for us to broaden our understanding of the problem of having this discussion this morning. We're delighted you will come out.
Well, thanks very much, Brian. I really am grateful for the opportunity to be here and see so many people come out on a nice Monday morning after so many students have been dumped on the campus over the course of the weekend, which I found out yesterday. It's a privilege for me to be here because I've greatly admired the series of forums you've had on presidency and science advising. Six volumes published so far, and I gather a couple more that are in process. I think those have benefited not only the science technological community, benefited some of the presidential scholars, and as witness your recent commission report, benefited the presidency himself. And, you know, this is valuable work. The focus that I'm going to have today, as Ken mentioned, is on science and technology advice to state governors. This is the result of a year-long study, which, as many things in life, started from a chance remark at a luncheon in New York City about 1 year ago, when my luncheon companion and I were jointly lamenting the paucity of information, published information, on advisory mechanisms for science and technology within states. The contrast, of course, was a great deal of information now on science advice to the president, organization of OSTP within the White House, and so forth. I said, well, I have a couple of weeks before the faculty descend on me. I'll see what I can come up with. That was, of course, a year ago, and I'm now closing in on the tail end. I did the obvious first step, which was to do a literature survey, which netted exactly zero citations. Now, that I either concluded that I didn't know how to search literature or not much existed. The second of those was a little more palatable to my ego, so I then did the next obvious step, which was I simply wrote to 50 governors and basically said, what are you doing? And in particular, I asked them two questions. One, do you have a full-time science and technology advisor, office, or statewide commission which looks at SMT issues? And secondly, what are the half dozen or so major S&T issues you currently face, and how are these being addressed? I wanted to keep in this study the perspective of the governor, not the perspective of the scientists and engineers who would like to be heard by the governor. And I think that point has been made time and time again in the Presidency in Science Advising series of books by the various speakers. It's one thing to be, if you will, part of a professional lobby. It's another thing to actually be called upon to give advice by someone who needs it and is seeking it. So I've tried to maintain that perspective. And in retrospect, I think I may have wanted to phrase my original question to the governor a little more precisely to do that. I sent that letter out in August over the next couple months, actually reaching into Christmas and even into the new year. I received replies at that time from about 30 states, enough to get a sense about what was out there and some tentative conclusions. I wrote that up in a draft, which finally I was able to send out in early July, back to the 50 governors and to their advisors,
And now from that, I've received, as Ken mentioned, replies from 44 of the 50 states. When I talked to my secretary on Friday afternoon, she said a couple more had come in during the course of the week. So we're asymptotically approaching 50 out of 50. Since they are still, in fact, coming in, what I'm going to give you are some of my preliminary analysis and observations, and I'll be very grateful for your critique and feedback, questions and answers from yourself. First legitimate question one should ask is, why do governors need science and technology advice? Let me answer that by making the following observation. 4 weeks ago, the National Governors Association met for their annual meeting in Chicago. During the course of that, they approved policies or changes to existing policies in, amongst others, six areas, which I'll just highlight here quickly. One, protection of coastal areas in the United States, particularly to keep them fit for fishing and swimming, recreational activities. Two, transport of hazardous materials by train and plane, by highway, by waterway. Three, handling of hazardous waste materials. And this particular issue was in response to the EPA's requirement that by mid-October of this year, each state must certify to EPA that they have in their own state the capability of dealing with the hazardous waste they expect to generate over the next 20 years, failing which they may not participate in Superfund monies. It's a pretty heavy stick. The fourth, oil spill cleanup liability issues, very much driven, of course, by the Exxon Valdez disaster in Alaska on March 24. Fifth, commercialization of science and technology discoveries. And sixth, highway safety, particularly with respect to school bus design and safety of children being transported therein. Clearly, there's a set of issues that governors not only are talking about, but they're establishing policies about that have S&T dimensions. In addition, at the same meeting, the incoming chair of the National Governors Association, Terry Branstad of Iowa, set up three task forces. Now, the NGA is organized with a series of ongoing commissions on foreign trade. There's some on commerce, six or eight of them. But he has set up three new ones with the avowed intention of redirecting some of the focus and efforts of the governors. The three are education, global climate change, and waste management, particularly solid waste management. The task forces have been set up already. They are expected to report within a year, presumably at the next annual meeting, with action agendas comprising three parts. One, a description of the problem and the issues that surface at the state level on those problems. Secondly, a consensus view of what might be reasonable and achievable goals for the 21st century. And third, some practical measures or steps that might be taken initially to work towards those goals. One can conclude quite rapidly that governors are involved with S&T issues. They are on the front line. Indeed, with some apologies perhaps to Bill Buckley, they're on the firing line. You know, who was the first public official to be on the Exxon Valdez after it crashed, before the day was out, was the governor of the state of Alaska, who was at Three Mile Island within a matter of hours when that disaster hit some 10 years ago. It was Governor Thornburgh. So governors really are on the front line and on the firing line. So there is, at least I think from my standpoint, a legitimacy to making the study, and I'm very glad to be one paving perhaps some ground here for others to follow later on. What have I found? I found that roughly half of the governors have science and technology advisors. Most of those are full-time. Most of those have a title like science advisor or science and technology advisor or technology advisor. Some of them have other titles. They may be the chairman of the Governor's Commission on Science and Technology or the president of the State Research Authority, but they are recognized both by the governor and by the person as being the advisor, if not in name, in fact. In reviewing the comments that both governors and the advisors made, it's very clear that they wear many hats, and I'll come back to that in just a second. Secondly, a larger number of states have science and technology offices or commissions or authorities or committees. My rough estimate is about 40. So there are very few states without them. These offices typically are embedded in the economic development structure of state decision making. They typically are guided by boards of directors, 10 or 20, in some cases even larger than that, influential citizens who are facilitators of whatever is going to happen. They tend to be highly placed people in the university, in government, and in industry. And there is almost always representation from both the public and the private sectors, including in the educational world. I can use the state of Washington as one example. We have a Washington Technology Center, which was our state's response in the early 80s to high technology for jobs creation, putting it very crassly. I was on the original ad hoc group that got together over a period of months to design that and set it up. I've been on the board ever since and am now vice chair of it. We have representation from the two major state universities, University of Washington, Washington State University, and most of the work goes through those two entities. But there's also representation from what we call the regional universities, Western Washington, Eastern Washington, as well as the private universities like Seattle University and Gonzaga universities who have graduate programs in science or engineering. We have governmental representation, certainly observation at every one of our meetings, and we have a large number of highly placed executives from industry. We have had, since the start, at least one vice president from Boeing on the board. Same is true for Weyerhaeuser. We've had presidents or CEOs from some of the other industrial firms, such as John Fluke Manufacturing or Tektronix, electronics people, as well as CEOs from smaller startup companies who then get into some of the venture capital side as well. The point is that there's a coming together of the people to make something happen, and there's a great pragmatism I found. If somebody needs to be brought on board to make the program happen, bring them on board. We'll worry about the niceties later on about whether we've got nice representation over in the state and so on and so forth. Those are always political considerations, but there's a pragmatism that generally transcends that. Only three of the statewide offices were set up before the 1980s. So we're looking at a relatively recent phenomenon. Those three were North Carolina and New York in 1963 and Hawaii in 1965. So we are looking at a relatively recent phenomenon. So in some ways, the jury is still out on the overall effectiveness of these. Let me turn now to some of the functions of first the science advisor. And I'll just pick one of the states, the state of Arkansas, because it happens to be in front of me. He wears many hats. The advisor in the state of Arkansas is president of the Arkansas Science and Technology Authority, created about 5-6 years ago. First of all, he provides information, analysis, and advice to the governor and his senior staff on issues that have S&T components. He serves as the governor's representative to the National Governors Association Working Group on State Initiatives in Applied Research. You'll hear me mention that several times in the course of the talk, the NGA Working Group. It is constituted by essentially 50 representatives of governors, usually the state science and technology advisor, though not always. Set up only 4 years ago, meet twice a year, and they share information about what programs they have underway. They then went through a period where they shared information on how to evaluate programs for their effectiveness. They are now moving into a phase of linking up and coordinating with federal efforts. And I think the next step may well be spinning off from the NGA as a separate group. You know, they have the dichotomy, obviously, as a working group within the National Governors Association of not stepping too far out of the accepted political mold that the governor will support. That gives you, of course, a great deal of political support, but it does put a little bit of a limit on what you can freely say and do. The Arkansas Science Advisor also represents the governor on the Southern Technology Council, multi-state consortium, serves on the governor's economic development sub-cabinet, so has a policy role as well as just an advisory role, responds to science and technology issues that are raised in the governor's office from constituents or however it's raised, and finally is responsible for directing the state's technology development programs. So not only is an advisor and a policymaker, but an implementer. These people wear many hats. In like manner, when you turn to the commissions, they too are involved not only in setting policy and advising the governor, but as often as not, in fact, probably more frequently than not, implementing programs, most of which have job creation, new company formation, maintenance of old companies, transferring of technology as their bottom lines. They exist, obviously, to benefit their own states, and if the other states are anything like Washington, I can remember in the first couple years of the Washington Technology Center, we spent probably the majority of our time worrying about intellectual property rights, legal agreements for transfer of technology between universities, between faculty and universities, between universities and companies outside, embodied in a Washington First policy. I'm sure every state has something similar to that. It is state monies, after all, that are being poured into this. It is therefore the citizens of that state that ought to be the first beneficiaries of the results. And that's a struggle, because how do you define an in-state company versus an out-of-state company? Does a major manufacturing plant count with the headquarters elsewhere? What about a sales office? Terribly interesting set of discussion, but I'm glad that those are mostly over. These commissions worry about many of the same things that the advisors do. They want to increase opportunities for employment within the state. They want to develop the human, economic, and natural resources within the state. They keep up a dialogue, in almost all cases, partly because of their makeup, with the higher education establishment, primarily the land grant or major research universities, though in just about every case that I've seen, the private universities are also drawn into the discussion. They want to maximize research capabilities of those universities. They want to transfer that technology. And they want to be seen in some way as an international or national leader in bringing the fruits of science and technology to the, quote, ordinary, unquote, citizen. Whether or not a state has an advisor or commission, people tend to be involved in both advice and implementation. The efforts tend to be coordinated over a variety of major actors, and both public and private bodies work together. Let me turn just to one state that has neither. The state is Tennessee, and let me just go through, from the governor's staff's perspective, major issues either right now or in the last year or two. They are 8 in number. First is radioactive waste storage. After all, Tennessee is the home of Oak Ridge National Labs. It's a major long-term issue for them. Second, major national science and technology competitions, most recent of which was the superconducting super collider, for which Tennessee was one of those who put forward a proposal. Third is management of Kentucky Reservoir and its biological resources. Fourth, development of a groundwater management strategy. This is the home of TVA, after all. Fifth, hazardous waste disposal. We already had nuclear, now we have hazardous. Six, acid rain and air pollutants. Seven, solid waste minimization. So now we've seen the three major types of waste, nuclear, hazardous, and solid. And then eighth, commercialization of technology. In each of these cases, the governor's office set up a different mechanism to get the data, to come up with options, and then to implement them. And I pick on Tennessee partly because I have some detailed information of how they addressed each of these 8 issues, but it is common within states to set up what you might call ad hoc groups to solve individual problems. At first blush, you'd say this is radically different from the national model where you have an ongoing Office of Science and Technology Policy in the White House. If you look at that a little more deeply, you find out that that is almost exactly what they do in the White House. They set up an ad hoc panel to deal with cranberries under Eisenhower, if you remember back in those times. And, you know, you have, at that time, the White House science advising apparatus was heavily dominated by physicists who generally don't know a lot about cranberry juice. So what did they do? They set up an ad hoc panel to look at that. And that's been, for the last 30 years, the dominant mode of operation at the presidential level, the setting up of panels that exist for 2 months, 6 months, a year, depending on the topic. What is different between the national and state models is that there's an ongoing set of actors, the president's science advisor and his immediate staff, to manage that process. So there is some continuity of what the major topics are, how to organize and go about this. At the state level, they're still coming into that task, and usually if there is a science and technology issue, like in state of Tennessee with that suite of issues, there will be somebody on the governor's senior policy staff who sort of has that portfolio of orchestrating these ad hoc arrangements. Let me turn now to the, from the governor's perspective, the major issues facing the states. And I've pulled off four of them. Now, each of the governors and their staffs sent back answers in slightly different forms. One might say high technology for job creation as a single category. Another state might mention eight different sub-issues inside of that. So I will be doing a little lumping here of those responses. But overwhelmingly, the first issue is job creation, using science and technology discoveries and creating new jobs. Governors are very tied into the economics of their states. If they aren't, they're not going to be back in the next term. They respond very quickly to the creation of jobs and the converse of that, loss of jobs for whatever reason in an area. Because they realize that without plentiful, well-paying jobs, the state's economy is going to falter. Second issue is education, with an emphasis on science, mathematics, and engineering, has two subcomponents. The first, the more immediate one, if you will, is linking up with the major research universities to create the R&D manpower, but secondly, and in the long run, perhaps more importantly, K-12, ensuring that all students go as far as they can in science and mathematics and engineering, so that in the time frame that they will be out in the workforce, they understand the dominant tools at their disposal. The third is technology transfer, taking of ideas out of the university or national laboratories and bringing them out into the marketplace, either by creating new companies, indeed industries in some cases, or modernizing existing industries. This rapidly gets over into the whole economic development set of policies in the states, and perhaps one reason why S&T and economic issues are so linked. If you're going to set up new companies, you have to have a financial and a legal environment that will foster that and make it easy to set those up. And then the final set of issues, or suite of issues, is the environment. Tennessee, we already mentioned nuclear hazardous and solid waste, but it encompasses water resources, disposal of waste, oil spills, etc. So those are the major issues that are seen from the governor's perspective on that they think are important. In those states that indicated where they are targeting new technologies, the two that came up more frequently than any others were biotechnology, with lots of different understandings of what biotechnology means, but biotechnology and advanced materials. We're rapidly moving into an era of new materials for every purpose. Now I'll turn to a couple questions. Is there a particular advisory model that works best? No, there is not. The needs differ dramatically from state to state. The population, the economy, the natural resources differ by two or three orders of magnitude in the different states. Each state has a different culture in the relationship between public bodies and private entities and industry and education. That profoundly affect how things are put together. And at least from my survey, there simply are too many successful models that are radically different. So I conclude that there is no single best model. The second question is, well, amongst the better models, are there common elements? And to this I answer, yes, there are. And I have concluded there are five common elements in these better models. And virtually every one of those models has them. First, it is comprehensive and strategic. That is, they have concluded they cannot do everything, cannot afford it, they don't need to. So they focus in on their efforts and channel their resources. Secondly, focused applied research. They decide based on their existing strengths or their perceived needs for the future to focus on a small number of areas to put their research and development dollars. And these can range across the spectrum of mechanisms. They can be grants to individual researchers. They can be the establishment of large interdisciplinary centers of excellence. But they do focus those dollars for applied research. Third is explicit plans about technology transfer. It's an onerous task to sort out intellectual property rights and the legal agreements for doing that, but you have to have a plan in place to make the overall science and technology apparatus work. Very closely aligned to that is the fourth item of seed and venture capital, part of the environment that I talked about before that encourage new company formation and private funding for taking inventions to the marketplace. And fifth is education. Again, the two components of the university level and K-12. In one sense, both short-term and long-term issues there. In summary, I would say that science and technology advising at the state level is summarized, characterized primarily by diversity. There's a variety of needs, radically different resources, varied organizational approaches, many of them very successful, and an emphasis on ad hoc approaches which are very practical in nature. The time frame that governors need to have results, and state legislators, is short. Which is one reason why the NGA Working Group has spent a lot of time worrying about evaluative measures. We have worried a lot at Washington Technology Center because we are called before the legislature every year to defend our requests for state funding and to say we have produced so many jobs, we've set up so many new companies, we've got so many inventions, et cetera, et cetera. There's another thing I haven't touched on at all, but I should mention it just as a sidebar. This exists at the national level as well. There is a very large number of scientists and engineers embedded in the departments and agencies of government, which is very different from the case of the Sputnik era, when you basically had to go to the universities to bring the scientists in to say what we ought to be doing and help manage that response. If you go to Washington, D.C. now, you will find about 300 or so staffers on Capitol Hill alone who come out of science and engineering. That creates a level of expertise which means you need a different advisory apparatus if you can count on that. Indeed, many governors in their responses made a point of saying that, well, while I have a commission and have my advisor, in fact, I call on whoever I know, and they know a lot of people. The networks of personal contacts within states, partly because they're far smaller than the federal government, is extraordinary. And in the state of Washington, Booth Gardner can, on just about any issue that has science and technology, and by implication other issues as well, can pick up the telephone and know three or four people he could call to get an immediate response to an answer to a question. So there is that informal network that transcends or side by side works along with this more formal advising apparatus. Let me simply conclude by saying that in the past year I've discovered a great vibrancy in the states. Nowhere is this more apparent than in areas that have science and technology related issues. Governors recognize the need for sound S&T advice, and they are very actively engaged in obtaining it. So with that as an introduction, I'll be glad to listen to your critique and questions. Thank you.
Thank you. I would like to raise the first mic to me. First question in my mind is the funding of these programs. Is it strictly state? Is there federal funds provided or how?
All of the above, but plus some more. Let me use the state of Washington. A, because I know it best, and B, because as far as I can tell, it is relatively typical. The Washington Technology Center derives its funding from three sources. State provides ongoing administrative costs and a small amount of monies that are very flexible. We get considerable sum of money from the federal government through competitive grants, research and development grants. And third, we have a lot of gifts, both cash and in kind, and in people, from the industries we work with. We have, as a strip all of the niceties of the legislation away, it's technology transfer. How to get ideas out of a couple of powerhouse universities into the marketplace is really why we exist. We've accreted a number of other functions along the way, but that still is really why. So the industries have been very forthcoming with some of their best people, loaning them to us for a year, giving us equipment that we simply couldn't afford to go out and buy. So you have those three sources of funding, and usually the state portion is the smallest of the three, but it's the one that is kind of ongoing and gives the director or the president, whatever his name is, of whatever authority or commission, some flexibility in moving rapidly. Generally, in providing some seed money. We, thinking back, our executive director 4 or 5 years ago put $40,000 or $50,000 of seed money into one particular researcher who was dealing with some esoteric ceramic materials that he thought might have some payoff in some future year in superconducting. Lo and behold, a couple years later, this was a pretty red-hot field, and now there's a couple $1 million of external funding coming in. So there's very high leverage on there. Generally, the states look not at providing the major costs. They look at providing seed money, leverage money, which actually raises an interesting point. At some stage, you have to ask yourself the question. I've raised it time and time again in the state of Washington without a clear answer. And I'm not sure how you actually find the answer, because having controls in the scientific sense is not real easy to do, is what value have these commissions or foundations or centers added? I can't believe, in my most recent example there, that this one researcher would not have been very successful by himself using this ordinary university resources. I do believe that we added something to it. I don't know how to measure that, though. I can measure the total output, but I'm not sure I can measure the differential output very well, which, at least amongst those who worry about this, means that you try to collect as many different types of measures, and there are 30 or 40, 50 of those, and from all of those together, you can get a sense that, at the very least, you're not harming the situation, and you probably are helping it.
Thank you.
go back to the old Hippocratic Oath, the first tenet of a physician is to do no harm to the patient.
So. Wouldn't the states do well, maybe you really said this, I'm not sure, do well to focus their primary attention on things like in Illinois, Iowa, that part of the country, new uses for corn would make it a more valuable product. And similarly, a local state focus, and I'm not talking about trying to set up a set of rules or a federal law or anything, just the instinct for what most appropriately be a good state function, which is a little narrower and more specific, more focused than the general federal.
I think the answer to that is they do exactly that. And that was one of my characteristics of the better programs, that they do focus quite carefully their research and development monies. In the state of Illinois, they, in fact, they don't do it on corn, but they have some major coal research centers. State of Iowa is, in fact, dealing with the translation of corn products into a variety of other products. Very much involved with that and bringing the resources of science and technology to bear on that. So there is, in fact, exactly what you say, a definite interest in building on the existing base. There are some times, however, where the existing base is clearly on the way out. Take a state like Pennsylvania, which has suffered the loss of two-thirds or three-quarters of the jobs in the steel industry. They have chosen, quite consciously, to go into high technology, supercomputing, software development, robotics, and they are amongst the national leaders now in that. And if you go into Pittsburgh now, you'll find that that is the dominant part of the economy, not steelmaking anymore.
Oops, I was just wondering, how do you control keeping politics out of some of these decisions? Because it certainly has to be acknowledged, and yet your governors are, what, four-year terms?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there is politics in these turnovers.
You cannot keep politics out of this. In fact, if you tried, you couldn't do anything. I tend to look at politics in the best sense of the word, of trying to bring people together and working through the differences to develop an implementable program. And I don't find a large disparity of views that science and technology is important to the governor and it's not important at all and is a campaign issue for his opponent. I haven't observed that. You may have some nuances inside of that, but there seems to be a pretty solid base in government circles, university circles, industrial circles, that these efforts are important. And usually the debate is over, well, we only have so much time and energy and money and people, which should we do first? And since the people driving a lot of this process themselves are from the industrial community, they know the value of husbanding and focusing the resources. And as often as not, they're the ones to drive decisions on the focus. You know, let's limit to these three or four things. Once again, state of Washington, in the Washington Technology Center, we only have six major programs. We've decided very consciously early on a combination of what we saw far out in the future and what we have right now in terms of resource base, what's possible. And we, you know, it's very easy to come up with a list of 30 or 40 items that you'd like to work on. We condense that down to six. Mm-hmm. And at the state level, too, partly because of the rapid time frame that you have to show results, things are stopped if they're not showing results. And a good executive director of a commission or a center will kill a program that's not cost effective and take that money and put it into another program just as an ongoing mechanism to ensure cost effectiveness. And I found using state monies, they are more responsive than my couple decades of involvement with using federal monies.
Does your data reflect some possibility of differentiating between R&D activities, which after all are rather old and go back for many decades before the 1980s, and agriculture, highway construction, and so forth, and actual science advising, which means getting the latest knowledge scientifically into governors' decisions one way or another?
At the state level, the distinction is not usually made. And that, I would say, is maybe the major difference between what exists at state level and what exists at the national level. You don't have, you know, White House staff both providing advice and implementing programs. Not always. When they do, they get in deep trouble. Readily between, you know, those people that solely worry about implementation, those that solely worry about advice. And while I've mentioned that these commissions and so forth are basically a product of the 1980s, there have been forerunner agencies or authorities in different areas, whether it be environment, whether it be transportation is a very good example. We tend to forget the importance of our transportation infrastructure in the United States and how much money went into that and how much care and thought and engineering over the period of many decades. And it's still a major issue. Witness the latest National Governors Association meeting when they set some new policies on that.
I wonder if I could ask two interrelated questions. The first, perhaps briefer, to what extent do the advisory groups in the different states coordinate and cooperate, exchange materials and ideas? And secondly, I was just thinking as you were talking how, as I'm doing these processes, state advising seems to be less fraught with political tension sometimes than national advising. I mean, there are obviously exceptions both ways. But to the extent that that's true, I wonder if that derives from the fact that states don't usually touch upon defense issues and foreign policy issues, whereas advising at the federal level will have that component.
The first question, what coordination goes on between the states? Largely that happens through the National Governors Association working group that I referred to. There are 49 advisors on that. Only one state is not represented on that. I won't say that, which one. And they've gone through an evolution in the 4 years since they've been set up. First was simply sharing of information. What are you doing over there? Once that was done, then they moved into this series of discussions on evaluation of those programs that were underway. It's a really tricky problem. And now they're moving on to the mega coordination with federal work. The National Science Foundation has, in fact, just set up some programming which will tie together databases from different states so that there's a general, much easier sharing of information across the states. So that is going on very well, and it's actually extraordinary within a period of 4 years that a group has come from zero to where they are now. Really extraordinary. The second is this political tension involved. That can differ radically. You can have an advisor called upon quite infrequently, which may well be the case in some of the Midwestern or mountain states. You may have others that are on the scene the next morning, like Henry Cole in Alaska when Exxon Valdez came upon Bly Reef. That particular advisor is under a great amount of political tension.
on deciding what science, environmental, and engineering studies need to be made, both short-term and long-term, to learn something from that disaster. You have, of course, a lot of other groups that have been set up to look at the mechanics of why it happened, how can we prevent it again, what rules and regulations and that kind. I think your observation that states are not typically involved with military, foreign policy, and defense matters, except as they might relate to jobs on major facilities, but I'll leave that as an aside, probably relieves a lot of that that in the midst of the fire tension that you might have at the presidential level. And of course, at the presidential level, you simply have more actors and you have more issues. So it's harder for one person or even a small group of people to orchestrate the whole. So it's an easier job at the state level in that sense.
May I ask a couple of have you stopped beating your wife type questions?
I never started.
One that we often hear is that leave all this to private industry, leave it to the universities. After all, the universities, including yours, are the places where the basic work is going on. Why do you need a public agency in the picture? Second, have you stopped beating your wife? The question is something that privately DeSimone referred to when he was here last week, a fellow who was deputy office of technology assessment and then executive director of the engineering groups. He said it's just too difficult in some cases. It's such a terribly difficult area to get into, and just for the ordinary reader in this state, why we keep hearing about the difficulties the Center for Innovative Technology has had. Now it seems to be on a more stable footing, but it is a tough area. And the third is the time-honored question that they used to ask foundations, and I'm sure ask every agency that's trying to do something. What are the success stories? Is there anything you can point to that really is evidence of success that legitimizes the whole undertaking?
Sure. The first one, why do we need the state involvement at all in some of these matters? I think there's a common recognition that by having some state involvement, because they have some resources, they do create the regulatory legal environment that a lot of companies have to operate in, and obviously the tax environment they operate in, that by having some involvement, we can get more out of the separate actors than we can by having the separate actors go their own way. And I think the data show that in virtually every case, you do have all three actors, the universities, the industries, and the government. One of the major actors, this is a sidebar here, that I don't see involved very often is the whole labor movement, which is interesting because since underlying so much of this is an element of job creation, the labor movement is not very active in these programs. That might be an indication that so many of these programs are concentrated in industries where labor has a small presence now, but I make that observation. Secondly, the difficulty, yes, there are difficult problems out there, but maybe the answer to that is what I referred to earlier as a pragmatism. You have about as many people sitting around the table as we have here worrying about what to do at the state level, and if you've got the right caliber of folks, as we do around the table here, somebody is going to say, if we don't do it, it's not going to get done. And that's exactly a comment that one of the CEOs made at one of our very early ad hoc meetings before we set up the Washington Technology Center. If we don't do it, nobody can do it. There's a little sense of egotism there, but there's also recognition that if you have the movers and shakers around the table, you can address it. Or turning that around, if it can be addressed, this group can do it. The third one of the success stories. I'll use the state of Washington as an example. We have the Washington Technology Center has been in existence for 6 years now. Our goal originally at the 5-year point was to be a couple $1 million a year operation. We are now at about $12 million a year operation. A couple million of that comes from state funding, largely to create the infrastructure of the center. And we're just finishing off a major facility, and they have provided the capital funds to construct that. The second source of monies was the industrial sector, and probably the federal grants and so forth, and the industrial sectors are roughly equal in terms of the funding that they brought to the table in one form or another. That's one measure of output. Another measure is how many invention disclosures have we made? And at this stage, we must have 35 or 40. How many companies have been created? We have set up 9 companies so far based on technologies solely derived out of Washington Technology Center's work. So, you know, there's a variety of measures you can use. How many jobs have been created? The number there probably is in several score, which is relatively small. But then we are relatively young, as most of these statewide programs are, which argues also for the variety of different measures that you can sustain it through infancy and adolescence to get into some sort of mature adulthood in the programs. And I think you could look at some of the other states, the Thomas Edison program in Ohio, or the Ben Franklin Partnership in Pennsylvania, where they have poured in a lot more state funding than Washington has, with very comprehensive technology programs, with some dramatic success stories in terms of total numbers of new companies and jobs created, and jobs saved in a lot of cases.
Yeah, I had the opportunity to this first of a series of conferences, which has been set up by Congressman Bauer, who's the assistant majority whip in my district in Virginia. This was held in July. The purpose of this was to survey the availability of resources and funds at the federal and state level, how best or how can we better coordinate this in terms of healthcare delivery. I came away with that with 2 or 3 distinct impressions. One, there is a multiplicity of sources, but the coordination between the state and the federal government and private foundations certainly needs a lot of additional emphasis. Secondly, I was very much impressed. I sat in on the 2 sessions, one with the health, the other by Eva T, who is the head of human resources for the state of Virginia's disabilities. But the thing that came through there was that for, say, blindness or for hearing or various disabilities, each of these areas had private funding, state funding, federal funding, but they had a complexity of tier 4 services. And the thing came through is the dedication of these people with all this complexity they were bringing to the area, I thought, really a terrific service. But Bosher is planning on having additional meetings to say when federal legislation is acting in Congress, how can we best integrate that at the state level? So I think this addresses your question on, yes, where we are and how we go. And I think this is an excellent beginning.
I think those are good observations. The point about increased coordination, I think a lot of that is, in fact, happening through the NGA working group. Of course, I'm also old enough now to know that if you spend all of your time trying to coordinate something, nothing gets done. So I'd rather have a multiplicity of folks doing their own thing and trying to figure out some of these informal networks, ways to minimize undue duplication. The second thing about complexity with the number of different actors, since I have worked on the health side a fair amount in my life, I would say in general the types of relationships I found in the science and technology slash economic development arena have been less complex than you find in the whole health arena. That's just a cursory observation. In one sense, we in science, technology, slash economic development have been around not as long as the health sector. We haven't had enough time to put together this web of myriad results. That's not to say that there isn't complexity in some of these and that we get some of the work done in spite of some of the rules and regulations. And we've been subjected in the state of Washington to a fair number of those disruptions. Just the sort of bureaucratic, hierarchical thing. But you know, we've gotten work done in spite of that. And there's no ill will in that I found. It's just a question of, usually, of trying to link up the provision of resources with the end result that's expected. Which is one reason why so very frequently you find the science and technology advisory mechanism embedded in the economic development infrastructure of the state, because they see that ultimately as the end result, the economic development of the state, not knowledge for someone's sake.
We're going to try whenever possible to adjourn our meetings after an hour's session, because some of you do have other meetings. Tom, did you have or anybody have a final question?
Did you learn anything unusual or particularly interesting in your response from the state of Virginia?
I'm still trying to figure out exactly how the Virginia Center for Innovative Technology and its satellite centers feeds into the whole thing. It looks on the surface to be one of the more comprehensive attempts to focus on the technology transfer spectrum of any of the states that I come across. So in that sense, I applaud you. From an outsider from 2,500 miles away, it's not completely clear whether you're trying to do too many things with that. But I could almost make that same comment for most of the states. I think just by the very nature of this survey, you know, I've gotten the sort of top millimeter layer off, and most of this is not in the depth that I would like to have. Every time I read through my materials again, there's another 20 questions I'd like to ask people. And if I had several lifetimes, I'd do it.
If any of you have other questions, perhaps you could ask them after we adjourn. I think of all the speakers we've ever had at the Miller Center, Terry has shown more restraint on one subject than it's almost human. And that is, not a word has been said about the fact that Seattle is number one now, according to all the ratings. And this kind of humility is not usual within, at least within the university I work. So we congratulate you. And if anybody wants to ask that question privately, well, they can.
Well, thank you for having me. I really did appreciate the feedback and the conversation we've had today. Thank you.